Welcome back, my friends, to AA Recovery Interviews. I'm your host, Howard L., and I'm an alcoholic. Sober since January 1st, 1988, one day at a time. I'm grateful you've joined us. AA Recovery Interviews is the podcast where Alcoholics Anonymous members from around the world share their extraordinary stories of experience, strength, and hope. There are over 145 interviews in this podcast series, available on all podcast apps. You can also listen to every episode from the past 3.5 years on my website, aarecoveryinterviews.com. Now, imagine you've been sober a while and moved to a new country. You don't speak the language, and the nearest English-speaking AA meetings are 1.5 hours away. How would that affect your sobriety and serenity in your new digs? My guest on today's show, Lisa F., faced that uncomfortable situation when she moved from the U.S. to Sicily in 2020. Sober nearly 15 years at the time, Lisa faced the loss of her daily meetings and in-person fellowship she had enjoyed in New York City for so many years. Though Zoom offered remote meetings, Lisa knew that the quality of her sober life in southern Italy was inextricably linked to her face-to-face involvement in the program. She had learned this the hard way when she first relapsed after her initial run at sobriety, a period marked by her declining commitment to and interest in Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time Lisa made it back to AA in 2004, her life was a shambles and ready for change. Knowledge from her earlier stint in Alcoholics Anonymous proved of little benefit until she got down to causes and conditions. With the help of a dedicated sponsor, Lisa immersed herself in a program replete with daily meetings, prayer and meditation, sponsorship of other women, and ceaseless service work. She has used the experience gained from that well-worked program to help build a robust English-speaking AA community with meetings in Sicily. Lisa's story covers a lot of ground, but will inspire those who face the same kind of challenges as she did. As a cautionary tale, it speaks clearly to the misnomer Lisa had used for years prior to her relapse when she told others that she didn't drink because she used to be in AA. The futility of that idea comes through loud and clear. There's much more to enjoy in the next 60 minutes of AA Recovery Interviews with my friend and AA sister, Lisa F.
Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Lisa. I really want to thank you for doing this today. You are in Sicily.
I'm in Sicily. I've been living here since December of 2020. I moved here during the pandemic in order to request dual citizenship to become an Italian citizen. So I'm now both an American and an Italian citizen. I have two passports. It's really quite something. And the Italian passport actually allows me to live and to work anywhere in Europe.
The thing that intrigued me was the fact that you were in the process of trying to get some meetings going there. And I've had other guests on the show, one in particular, a woman by the name of Ksenia, who is from Croatia, and she was involved in getting, she's been sober over 30 years, and she was responsible for getting many meetings started in different parts of Croatia, and she was also involved in the translation of the Big Book into Croatian. So I'm always intrigued and interested whenever I hear of somebody going to that extent to do service work for the benefit of their own AA program. What did you find when you came in 2020 to Italy with regard to AA?
Well, because of the health crisis, we were already on Zoom.
Right.
So I was used to dialing into meetings every day, and at that point, probably 2 or 3 times a day on Zoom. And I didn't realize that AA really doesn't exist here in English. Mm-hmm. And in Italian-speaking meetings, they are in Palermo and in Catania. Mm-hmm. And I live 1.5 hours away from Catania and 3.5 hours away from Palermo. And when I got here, didn't speak a word of Italian. So it was impossible for me, to go to those meetings. So I stayed on Zoom. Mm-hmm. And an amazing thing happened on Zoom. There was a young woman from my home group, NYU, who was moving to Sicily to work at the United States Navy base here. And someone told her that I was at this meeting. They texted her and said, dial into the meeting. There's a woman on the meeting right now who lives in Sicily. So we wound up getting in touch, and the U.S. Navy asked her to start a meeting for the service people at the Navy base in Catania. So when she arrived and we met each other, we started up an English-speaking meeting there. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because mostly people that were not service people that we were able to get onto the base, what made it impossible to list the meeting with the European intergroup. Mm-hmm. There were all of these security clearances that you had to go through in order to get to the meeting. Mm-hmm. So that went on for about a year. And then another couple from the UK who are now living here in Sicily, the four of us got together and started a meeting in Catania. That's an English-speaking meeting, and we're starting to get tourists who are visiting the island walking into the meeting. So,
is that a big port for cruise ships as well?
It is, and so is the town that I live in. Mm-hmm. And so is Palermo. Those are the three most populated towns in Sicily are Palermo, Catania, and Siracusa, in that order.
So you say you were driving an hour to an hour and a half to get to Palermo and Catania from where you live?
Well, to Catania. So actually, I take the bus. Mm-hmm. So it's a 6 to 7 hour excursion for the 1 hour meeting.
Wow, what dedication to your sobriety and to AA in general. That's wonderful.
You know, for me, it's totally, I mean, to be in an in-person meeting, you know, I would travel twice that amount of time in order to have the in-person meeting in English. I now know enough Italian that I can go to an Italian-speaking meeting and at least understand the top line of what's going on.
Good for you. You sound like my type of person that enjoys AA to the extent that we would travel and go out of our way to make it to a meeting. And nobody told us exactly how long it was going to be from meeting to meeting. I think it's great. And you mentioned New York City. Is that where you were living previously?
Yes, I'm a New Yorker. I am a native New Yorker, born and bred.
So you have literally thousands of meetings a week, as do we here in Houston. And I think it's so easy to get spoiled by, if you can't get to one meeting, you can get to another. You can literally plan your meetings around your schedule, given how many meetings there are. And people lose sight of the fact that in a lot of rural communities and in other parts of the world, sometimes it's difficult to find an AA meeting if you can find one at all. And so when you find one, you definitely want to support it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's been quite a radical change, you know, to go from being able to go to a meeting at 6 o'clock in the morning until 2 o'clock in the morning if I wanted to. The opportunity to be in touch with the literature, mm-hmm. to hear great speakers is extraordinary in New York.
It is. And wherever two or more are gathered, that's all we need for a good AA meeting. So have you always gone to meetings when you've traveled?
Always. I've been to meetings in Cusco, in Peru, you know, in the Amazon, in Mexico, in Australia. That's one of the greatest joys, is being able to go anywhere in the world, mm-hmm. and be able to say your name and your status and to be understood and to be able to connect and have basically family, you know, wherever you go.
I think there's something very comfortable about going to an AA meeting in a city you're visiting. It always makes me feel like I'm at home. Do you get that sense?
Absolutely. At home, comfortable, listening to the language of the heart. It's universal. That meeting that I mentioned in Peru, in Cusco, they were speaking Quechua, you know, a very local indigenous language in the mountains of Peru. And it didn't matter. Like, I knew in the qualification by the tone of the person's voice where he was in his story.
Mm-hmm. I was curious as to how you found the podcast. I know it's out there, and I've been doing it for the past 3 years, but I'm always intrigued when people send me a email or whatever saying that they've enjoyed listening. How did you initially run across it?
Googling AA podcasts. It was as simple as that, Howard.
Well, that's good to know. That's good to know. And in fact, if you Google AA recovery interviews, usually by the time you've gotten to the R or the E in the word recovery, it's popping up. So that's kind of cool. It's always great when I hear of somebody finding the podcast. How long have you been sober now?
This time, since May 26, 2004.
Uh-huh.
So I have my 20th, God willing, coming up next month, but not my first time. So this is a big year for me because I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous on August 16th, 1984, when I was 23 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That's a story. I have two stories. So the first story is how not to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the second story is about how to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was abstinent. I don't like to say sober because that was not my experience. I was abstinent for 15 years, went back out in the year 2000. So from 2000 to 2004, I relapsed and came back on May 26th, 2004. So this year is both my 20th and my 40th.
When you came back in 2004, did you feel like you had missed something from the first period of sobriety you had? Could you identify the thing that led to your slipping after being sober? You said abstinent, or what people might call dry, or sobriety, as I've heard it referred to. Was there something about that that you identified as missing from your program that caused you to slip in 2000?
Absolutely. I was an untreated alcoholic in Alcoholics Anonymous. And,
yeah.
You know, there's nothing more insane than being in a 12-step program and not working the 12 steps.
Uh-huh.
Or, you know, being someplace where they have a textbook and, you know, not opening the book. So I had this idea that all I had to do was go to the meetings and share my agony and how uncomfortable I was, and that was really what the recovery plan was. And for whatever reason, I organically did not go to meetings that were listed with BB for Big Book. Back then, you know, there was a paper meeting book. There was nothing online because there was no internet. T for tradition, S for step, L for literature, BB for Big Book. If it said any of that, I wasn't going. I just wanted the speaker meeting, because all I wanted was to hear a drunkalogue.
Uh-huh.
Because I thought if I stayed terrified of what happens when people drink, that would be my solution.
Did you find during that period when you were going to just speaker meetings that none of them were really addressing what was going on in your particular life at that point?
It was an interesting time also in Alcoholics Anonymous, because
uh-huh.
all of these other programs were sprouting up. A lot of therapeutic community language was coming into the rooms. And I really gravitated toward that, toward AA as group therapy. Like that's kind of the way that I was perceiving it. So even though I was going to meetings every day, the disease was not being treated.
Hmm. You were trying to do it yourself instead of working with the group to do it?
Yeah, I did have a sponsor for a while, and then she moved to California, and I never replaced her.
Mm.
So there were all of these, over the first 5 years, like cutting of tethers. You know, the sponsor was a tether. She moved. I clipped that. I changed, you know, from home group to home group. If I got angry at somebody, I'd go to a new meeting. You know, after 6 years, I was barely going to a meeting a week. And at around 10 years, I wasn't going to any meetings at all.
Hmm.
No meetings and no alcohol. So, you know, if there's not a solution, which is, for me, a higher power mm-hmm. that gets revealed to me through the literature, through sponsorship, through service, through working with others, through the meeting, you know, through using all the tools.
Mm-hmm.
So no alcohol and no solution.
Hmm.
So the disease was very profound in me.
Yeah, I get that.
There are people who say it's a mind-powered disease, and it was like that for me.
Yeah, I get that. In fact, I've known during my years of sobriety, as well as doing all these podcasts over the last 3 years, that you know, usually one or more of the tenets of the program starts to slip before the individual does. They let up on meetings, they let up on working the steps, they lose a sponsor and don't replace them, they're not reading or praying or being of service in general. How did you feel during that period of time, let's say you're 10, 12, 15 years in, and you're sober, but you're not working the program, sitting in a room of AA in the frequent meetings that you were attending, how did you feel when you were hearing about people with the kind of sobriety you had whose lives were getting a lot better by working the steps?
It irritated me beyond measure. That's why I stopped going, because I was like, you know, these slogans are ridiculous. You know, one day at a time, what are they talking about? Like, I have bills to pay. I have to figure out my life. I didn't really get it at all. I didn't get what the solution was.
Sounds like you were somewhat indignant to the program.
Indignant, restless, irritable, discontent, untreated alcoholism, really judgmental.
Did you feel that that was the best that AA could offer you?
I actually never blamed AA for it. I just was miserable because I didn't have a solution. And the people who were sharing the solution, I didn't want to hear what it was that they were doing. I actually said to somebody once, why would I read a book that was written in 1935 based on what's happening in my life right now? I just didn't get it.
Sounds like a powerlessness issue where you still retained what you thought was personal will and power over the things that other people had surrendered to be able to get the kind of recovery that you were seeing in the rooms around them. Is that a fair assessment?
Most certainly a fair assessment, and so different than the experience, you know, that I had getting actual recovery from everything that's, you know, that there is on offer in Alcoholics Anonymous.
You sounded really resistant to it. And I've known people who were dry. One of my good friends here in Houston has been sober for, I don't know, over 20 years. And he came into the program with 9 years of sobriety. And yet he had only really been working the program for less than a year. But yet when people hear how long you're sober, they don't bother to think, well, you've been sober for 20 years. Have you been working the program for 20 years? Have you been going to meetings for 20 years? Have you been sponsoring other people for 20 years? The assumption is that if you've been sober a long time, you must have it made. But the reason I was asking that particular question just now of you was that somewhere along the way, you must have seen the things that you weren't doing that other people were, and those things were working for them. Did you never draw a connection between the way that you were feeling and those particular solutions?
I did not. I absolutely did not. I mean, it's a very similar dynamic as it relates to the disease of denial. When a person is active and they cannot put together the results of what's happening in their life with their drink, they can't make that connection. I could not make the connection in the rooms that my life was miserable because I was not doing what was being suggested to me. I couldn't make that connection. Very similar to not being able to understand, I've now gotten arrested and it's because I was drunk. I couldn't, you know, you can't put those things together until you hit a bottom. And that was my experience not doing the program.
Now, did you have people around you, let's say from your early years in AA, who kind of kept up with you and maybe saw what you were doing in your non-attendance and non-participation in the program, who would talk to you about it? Did anybody ever call you on that? Or what was your experience?
Such a good question. I gravitated toward other people like me. I gravitated toward people who got to the meeting late and left early, people who were all about like hanging out at the diner and the fellowship. And there were people who cared. There were people who tried to talk to me, but it infuriated me. If anybody came up to me after the meeting and said anything to me about what I'd shared, I'd actually gotten to a point that when I would do one of my rants, because I was always ranting from the floor, you know that person.
They're a pain in the neck, but go ahead.
Exactly. At the end of the rant, I would say, and don't come up to me after the meeting, because I felt entitled. I thought that Alcoholics Anonymous was set up in such a way that I should go to the meeting, and I thought sharing was dumping.
That how the program worked was something that you could control and manage. So that first step had not really been applied in its entirety to your program. But, you know, a lot of this sounds like this kind of response to a program that somewhere along the way you decided you needed doesn't just show up. Usually it's something from further back in a person's life that kind of set the stage for that to happen later. Can you speak to what your early life was like, your family of origin?
Absolutely. So, you know, in our literature, they mention if we are to quit drinking, we must have no reservation whatsoever.
Right.
So because of my childhood, I had a secret reservation about my alcoholism. I grew up in the South Bronx in a very violent time, in a very scary neighborhood. I had a dad who was a gambler, and a lot of chaos in my home life and a lot of chaos outside of my home. And I started drinking very young. I needed relief by the time I was 12. And I did a lot of damage. So I drank from the age of 12 to the age of 23,
mm-hmm.
you know, when I came to AA the first time. In those years, you know, when other people had after-school activities and, you know, were thinking about what college they were going to, I was obsessed with the idea that I needed to learn how to drink normally and that I needed to figure out how not to have a blackout. Like that just characterized my drinking. You know, I had the self-diagnosis probably the first or second time I drank. You know, I had an obsession to pick it up, and I had a body with an abnormal response to alcohol.
Hmm.
Once I put it in my body, there was no way for me to say, was I going to have 5 or was I going to have 20? But I didn't put that together for many, 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 many years. Did not put that equation together for a really long time. But I had this reservation that I drank the way that I drank because of my childhood, which was a mistaken idea.
In what way?
You know, some people like myself come to the rooms with trauma, effects from a neighborhood, a family, an event. Some of us come more wounded than others. Those wounds, I have come to learn after many, many, many years, have nothing to do with my alcoholism. That my alcoholism is its own entity. Now, is it possible that my trauma led me to pick up my first drink younger than somebody else might have? Yes, that's probably true. But the fact that my body is different from other people's, and the fact that I have a strange mental blank spot that tells me that the next time I pick up a drink, it's going to be different. And that the reason why that crazy thing happened was because I had bad sushi. Like, I was born with that. I was born with that obsession and compulsion and a body that has an abnormal response and the phenomenon of craving. And I had no idea. Did the trauma exacerbate in the beginning? Absolutely. But I had a hidden thought, a hidden reservation in the darkest part of my mind that said, you know, Lisa, the only reason why you drank like that was because of your childhood.
Yeah.
Maybe you're not an alcoholic.
So as long as you've got something to attribute your alcoholism to, it kind of gives you an opportunity to let yourself off the hook, so to speak. Was there alcoholism in your family? You mentioned your dad and a gambling addiction. What sort of behavior or addictions did you see in your family of origin or in your extended family or that might have led you to believe, if you were an outside observer, this person's going to face some real problems along the way because of this family history?
It's interesting. There really wasn't a lot of drinking in my home.
Hmm.
My father was not a drinker. He was a gambler. My mother was not a drinker, but she was the adult child of a brutal alcoholic,
mm-hmm.
you know, somebody who wound up in a mental institution and died of cirrhosis of the liver. And many of her siblings were alcoholic. She was not, but she had a lot of mental illness, a lot of other stuff going on.
What did she tell you when you were young about that and some of the alcoholism that was in the family? Or did she just not talk about it?
You know, she never zeroed in on it as alcoholism. She never used that word. You know, she would only say the terrible things that happened to her in her home.
So they were never attributed to the alcohol, but instead they were all behavior oriented.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get that. I came from the same kind of background where neither of my parents drank. But there were all the other mental illness in the family. And in many ways, those kind of mental illnesses, like clinical depression, still pervade. But, you know, one of the things I was wondering is, did your mother ever recognize in you what she knew from her own experience in being the daughter of an alcoholic?
Not to my awareness. She never said anything.
She never said anything to me about it.
I mean, in terms of my drinking, because it started so young, she very much focused on my behavior. You know, I don't think that she really knew how bad it was. And I left home at the age of 16. So, and I moved to another state. I moved from New York to Florida on my own at the age of 16, left home. So she wasn't privy to the worst of it.
You know, I think it's real easy for someone who's going through that, where the cry for help is going out so regularly and so strong from the child, that when the parent doesn't notice it or say anything about it, even if they were going to do it in a negative way, they feel abandoned emotionally or betrayed emotionally. What were your feelings around that?
I mean, I'm still dealing separately. And luckily, the tools of the program I have found over these years help me in every area of my life. So, I mean, I can use inventory for many, many things. So to answer the question directly, ton of abandonment, ton of lack of worthiness, lack of value, lack of self-value, you know, all of those things that affect a child who comes from a severely dysfunctional home.
Yeah.
Where there are regular emergencies, financial emergencies, you know, just a lot of insanity. Thank goodness, you know, in recovery, I have the opportunity to get outside help. I get the opportunity to use the tools of the program in ways, you know, that are not specifically prescribed in the literature, but they work.
It does, and so does that relationship with people that you're close to, including a sponsor and trusted friends, where you can talk about the kind of things as an adult looking back that you can never talk with your parents about contemporarily. And, you know, what I found was my folks really, in about the time I got ready to do my amends and face my family, most of what had happened had been literally clinically forgotten by my dad having Alzheimer's. And, you know, so going to him saying, you know, this is what you were like when I was a kid, he had no recollection of it. And trying to talk to somebody about something that seems to not exist for them is very, very difficult. And it still resonates deep within me. But I can imagine if you left home at 16, did you leave home in a sense of escape, or were you just looking at, I need to strike out on my own and I'm not getting what I need here in the home?
All of the above.
Yeah.
I needed to escape. The tension between my mother and I was, you know, we had a very, very, very difficult relationship. And by that time my father was gone. You know, they divorced 4 years. They had separated and then divorced, and she was with someone else. And it was just very complex and very painful. And I felt the need to get out the door. I mean, I figured out alcoholics are, I went into human resources over years, but alcoholics are some of the most resourceful people on the planet. I mean, at the age of 15, I dropped out of high school, got an equivalency diploma, applied to every school that would accept an equivalency diploma, applied and got a grant so that I could go to school in Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, wow.
And moved myself to Florida and, you know, graduated with, I think, a 1.9 GPA.
So is it safe to say that your behavior drinking accompanied you and in that process and maybe hindered you from achieving what you might have otherwise achieved?
Absolutely. It was many years later that I, you know, in recovery, went back to school and actually had an educational experience.
You drank, you worked, you continued to do what you were doing. Can you take us up to that first period of sobriety when you very first went to AA? And what were the circumstances around that?
So it's the summer of 1984. I was working in the music industry. I had a total pass on drinking on the job because it was the early 80s in the music business. I mean, that was, although people say that probably about every profession. They're like, well, accountants, you know, we drink a lot. Lawyers, we drink a lot.
Sure.
The music business, we drink a lot. There were no consequences for my drinking and using on the job because I was actually doing it, you know, with my boss. And I was at a music conference and wound up on a tear for 3 days and woke up out of a blackout in a taxi on the 59th Street Bridge. At the time, I was living in Queens, and I didn't know what direction I was going. It was morning, and I didn't know if I was in a taxi going to work or if I was in a taxi going home. And nothing ever scared me in my life as much as that. Coming out of a blackout, being in a taxi, and not knowing if I was literally coming or going.
That is scary.
It was terrifying. Blackouts were the thing that really brought me to my knees at the age of 23. They scared me to death.
Had you always blacked out, or was that something that started happening as you came into your 20s?
The first time I drank, I blacked out.
Huh.
Blacked out, vomited, did things that were completely uncharacteristic of who I had been up until that moment.
So what was there about that particular moment in the back of a taxi cab, waking up from a blackout, that was so different from the others you had experienced up to that point that made you realize you needed some help?
That same day, a man that I was involved with, who was on his way back to London, said to me, "You know what, Lisa? You are so funny, you're so smart, you're so attractive, but when you drink, you turn into a different person, and I don't ever want to see you again." So I don't know what I said or did to him that night before, but he let me know that he was no longer interested. For some reason, that gutted me. It was a level of emotional pain that I had never felt before. It was like he punched me in the face.
Now, did that happen before or after the drinking that you did, that you passed out in the back of that taxi?
He told me that the next day. And then after that conversation with that nice young man, who I think saved my life at that point, I cried my eyes out before I went to sleep. And I was begging God, like, what is wrong with me? Please just tell me, what is wrong with me?
Mm-hmm.
And the following morning, I woke up, lit a cigarette, went to the telephone, called information and said, "Give me the number of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I don't even know where that came from. My only awareness of Alcoholics Anonymous was the film I'll Cry Tomorrow with Susan Hayward. I'd seen that film a couple of times with my mother. And that was the only reason that I knew the words Alcoholics Anonymous. A nice man was on the other end, and I don't know what crazy questions I asked him, but instead of just sending me to a meeting, he told me to come down to Intergroup. So I went. He and another woman explained to me what meetings were and what would happen when I went to the meeting. They gave me a meeting book. They made a couple of suggestions, and that was how I got to AA.
We'll be right back. My friends, if you're enjoying listening to my AA Recovery Interviews podcast, check out my latest audiobook, Alcoholics Anonymous, the story of how more than 100 men have recovered from alcoholism. This is the word-for-word, cover-to-cover reading of the first printing of the first edition of the Big Book, published in 1939. It's a relaxing and meaningful way to listen to the Big Book anytime, anyplace. Have a free listen at Audible, Amazon, or iTunes. While you're there, treat yourself to another audiobook I produced, Lost Stories of the Big Book, 30 original stories missing from the third and fourth editions of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's an engaging audiobook that brings these stories to life for AA members who've never seen them. These timeless testimonials were originally cut to make room for newer stories in the third and fourth editions, but their vitally important messages of hope are as meaningful today as they were when they were first published. many listeners will hear these stories for the very first time. Have a free listen to Lost Stories of the Big Book on Audible, Amazon, or iTunes. It's also available as a Kindle book and in paperback from Amazon. You're going to love it. And we're back. What did you encounter when you went to your first meetings, and what kind of attitude did you have towards getting sober at that particular time in your life?
I was completely surrendered, but I didn't really understand the nature of the illness that I had. And what I heard was, don't drink and go to meetings. And so that's what I did. I went to young people's meetings. I very much was attracted to the fellowship. I used to go to sober dances, young people's conferences, parties. I was still, in my mind, I guess, wanting a party.
Without the booze.
Yes. And, you know, going from one relationship to the next. You know, I think in the first 5 years, I was engaged twice. Was very hyper-focused on my romantic relationships.
What was there going on that you were ignoring or disregarding in that way to be able to continue to participate in all the social and fun things in AA with the fellowship, but you weren't doing the steps and you weren't working the program?
You know, I literally was really just not listening. I had this idea that I needed to stay terrified. So I really wanted down and dirty drunkalogs. Like, the worse your story was, the better for me. Because I thought that that was the answer. And, you know, today I completely gravitate to literature meetings and talking about recovery and the solution and transformation. And it's not that I don't want to hear somebody's story, of course. But the idea that I wanted to hear a drunkalog every single day, you know, is says everything about what I thought AA was supposed to be.
The early meetings for me were somewhat like that. I always felt it was like a game of can you top this, when people would say, oh, things were so bad, I was living under the bridge. And then the next guy to talk would say, yeah, well, I was living under the bridge in the water. And everybody was trying to have the best, worst story. So I found myself being able to identify with the stories, but absolutely nothing regarding the solutions to those problems. Did you have a sponsor at the time? Did you have anybody who was trying to guide you down a different path than the one that you were identifying with?
So the woman who I worked with first, the one who moved to California, was also very young, very lovely, and a very good friend. And we did the steps in the 12 and 12. That's actually not a step method. You know, the steps are outlined in the big book. The instructions are in the big book. But I still have, to this day, everything that I wrote. When I look at it today, I can see, like, wow, no wonder I didn't have a spiritual awakening. Like, no wonder there wasn't a psychic change, you know, that nothing happened, because we were just kind of making it up. Like, write down a list of all the times you were powerless. You know, write down a list of how your life is unmanageable. That's not necessarily going to get you a real first step.
That's all really helpful stuff on the way, though, isn't it?
It's helpful if it's included with the doctor's opinion, Bill's story, there is a solution, and more about alcoholism, right? That's step one. Those four chapters, step one in the text. So if I actually sit down with someone, as I did, you know, after 2004, and read that information line by line and get asked very profound and probing questions about how I do or don't identify with it. Share your experience. How was your experience like Bill's? Did you identify with the way that he felt? Do you understand the doctor's opinion? Do you understand that what the phenomenon of craving is? Tell me about the times that you drank against your own will. You know, that's a bit deeper and more profound than just making a list of unmanageability and what and a perceived powerlessness, because honestly, until I had worked those four chapters as a first step with the beautiful woman who did that for me, I didn't know what powerlessness meant. Another friend, I don't know if you know Kevin H, but he's somebody that's done a big book study for 28, 29 years in New York. And of course, he loves all the literature, but he makes this analogy about the big book and the 12 and 12, because the 12 and 12 is a book of essays that Bill wrote to flesh out more about each step and about the further experience, you know, that they had. But he uses this analogy, like the big book is literally, if you're traveling, it's the country that you're going to. The 12 and 12 is basically the footer's guide that says, hey, you know, you might find this when you get there. You might like this restaurant. But if you read only the footer's guide, but you don't get on the plane and go to the country that you're going to be visiting, you don't get to have the experience of that country. And that was my experience trying to go through the steps the first time, you know, I came to the program. I did not have a psychic change or a spiritual experience.
Between 84 and 2000, when you slipped, during that 16-year period, when did did your working of the program veer off track to the extent that you ended up not going to meetings, not doing the things that you should? Was there a defining moment or occurrence that you were on the right track and then something derailed you, or it was at a gradual decline?
It was almost imperceptible to me. So the easiest way that I can categorize it is to say that for 5 years, the first 5 years, I didn't drink. I went to meetings. So maybe I was a member. And then for the next 5 years, I stopped going to meetings very slowly. Three meetings a week, two meetings a week, one meeting a month, one meeting every other month. So it took 5 years for me to stop going to meetings. I went from a member to a visitor. And then the last 5 years, I was somebody who used to go to AA because at that point, I'd already started shooting pool with a group of people from work at a bar. And they'd say, oh, let me get you a beer. No, I don't drink. I used to go to AA. It's a great program.
You graduated.
Literally graduated, became somebody who used to go to AA. That was a long, slow, painful process. When they say cunning, baffling, powerful, the disease will sit and wait. It sat and waited until I mean, the whole time I was walking. You know, and they also asked the question, are you walking towards a drink or away from a drink? I was walking toward a drink for more than 10 years.
That's amazing. So along the way, you had the opportunity to have a drink anytime, and something about your being sober to that point, even though you weren't working a program or going to AA, got you to say no to the drink. What was there that was contributing to that, or how did that frame of mind come around?
Still terrified. I was still scared of what would happen. But so here's the real insidiousness. 2 years before I picked up the drink, I was in a relationship with a man who was a pot smoker. So the relapse really happened 2 years before. And I smoked some pot with this guy, but I didn't start smoking. I was never a pot smoker. It was never my thing. I had smoked pot, of course, you know, while when I was a kid. And I ignored it. I act like it didn't happen, like it never happened. Because now in the back of my mind, look, you had a little pot, you smoked a little weed, nothing happened. You're fine. Nothing happened. You're okay.
Because you were a drinker, not a pot smoker, right?
Exactly. And at that point, I hadn't been to a meeting in a number of years. And the explosion finally happens. I went to study dance in Cuba. And I was with all of these Canadians and Cubans and all of these people who were, you know, musicians and dancers. And they pull out a bottle of rum and they're passing it around in a circle. And the bottle is coming around the circle and making its way to me. And here is the dialogue that happens in my head. You know, Lisa, it was your childhood. You're not an alcoholic. Like, look at what your childhood was like. Now you've had all these years of therapy. You've dealt with what happened. You know, probably nothing's going to happen if you drink. And the final thing that it told me, just as the bottle was being put into my hand, was, well, you know, you're not sober. You smoked that pot 2 years ago. And that was it. And I picked up that drink. And 4.5 years of utter darkness, utter spiritual darkness. It was like somebody had rolled back the clock and I was 16 again, trying to control blackouts, trying to drink normally. I mean, it was horrific.
Sounds like you were in the dusk for a number of years before that darkness really hit.
Yes, it was actually the darkness of shame is what brought me to my knees and back home to Alcoholics Anonymous. Even though I'd never worked a program, I remembered the love and the tolerance and the patience and the acceptance and the understanding and the warmth and everything that I felt when I walked into a meeting. Like that had gotten under my skin, that had gotten into my heart, that had gotten into my soul. So to know that on some level and to be so far away from that, and the place where I was so dark and shameful that I couldn't take the feeling of shame anymore, because now I was like in my 40s and I was the head of HR at a company.
So you were a functional alcoholic that wasn't drinking until you slipped along the way.
And then when I started drinking, and during that period, I mean, I was working at a big record company. I was still in the music industry. And I was having people in my office after hours. I had a little bar in my office. I was the head of human resources.
And of course, in that business, there's a lot of that goes on. And a lot of enabling of the musicians and other people that probably contributed to a number of them having difficulty getting sober clean along the way. We often hear that if you slip and you drink again, the disease won't pick up where you left off. It'll start at a point at which you would have been at had you never stopped. Which of those two really applied to you?
The former. I was exerting as much control as I could. I was failing, but it's not like I had this radical progression and picked up and started drinking in the morning. Mm-hmm. It didn't happen like that for me. It was where I left off, which was the reoccurrence of blackouts. But like a blackout didn't happen every time. I didn't get in trouble every single time. So when I didn't, then I was able to say to myself, oh, you see, you went out last night, you had X amount and nothing happened. You're okay.
Did you ever get the sense that when you started drinking again, you looked back over the period of not drinking and thought to yourself, geez, why did I do that? I'm okay. I can drink. I'm proving it right now. I'm talking about within the first 4 years of that slip. Were there periods where you thought that you were wrong in your thinking about not needing to drink? What was your attitude?
I was very scared. I was scared through the whole relapse, because the blackout started fairly early into the relapse, and I started having to deal with cleaning up my behavior and apologizing to people, and so then I started just drinking at home because I was scared of, you know, what was happening out there. So I don't recall ever saying to myself, oh, you could have been drinking all this time. I knew on some level I was in the wrong place doing what I was doing on some level, like I knew it. But I didn't allow that to really come up into my awareness.
Yeah, I get that. And I see how that operated. So in HR, the HR people are usually the people who people with problems go to when they know that they're having a problem with alcohol or with drugs. HR deals with it in a way that is as anonymous as possible, trying to get the person as much help as possible and so forth. What did you know about that process working in the field and being an HR person? What did you know about the options for treatment and that sort of thing that you ignored in your own life?
You know, that's such a good question. You know, when I think about the chapter 2 employers and and what that has to say, you know, from 1935 to employers to the year 2000 or even before, you know, when I was working in human resources, there was still really not the emergence or the popularity of an employee assistance program. So like the EAP, you know, rehabs were only just starting to come into vogue. And in the music business, that's definitely not something, you know, that they were focusing on. Now, once I came back in 2004, I had the privilege and the good fortune, you know, to be able to do a lot of 12-step work from sitting in that chair, but not in the prior years. Really excellent question.
I've interviewed other professional musicians, and one of the things they talk about a lot is that not only were the people around them enabling them, but they were enabling them to do the things that seemed to be the status quo anyway. So I wondered if you ever saw that going on when you were working at the music company.
You know, I was probably so self-centered and focused on the other, like the other things that were happening in the music industry at that time were contraction around, you know, digital media. So my whole work life was always centered on how are we restructuring the company? How many people are we laying off? I was working 60 hours a week. Nobody was really focused on, is anybody drinking too much?
Let's talk about the road to ruin after this period of time. You had a lot of the feelings from the past come back. You had started smoking pot. You started drinking rum. What led up to the final days of you getting sober the second time?
You know, it was a very similar situation to the prior event. I was in Miami with the company that I was working for. All of the managing directors from this particular record label were all in town for this conference, for this convention. And I was supposed to be there as an executive, senior vice president level person, helping the communications team and all these people make a fabulous event for these executives. And I wound up getting angry at someone and I started drinking at them. And I'll show them. And before I knew it, I was in a blackout and woke up in a hotel room with someone. Let me not go into details. Let's just say with a person I absolutely should not have been with. I woke up, really wasn't even sure where I was. I was 3 hours late to where I was supposed to be to set up this executive breakfast for these other people, ran to my room, took a shower, got down to the event. A 20-year-old college intern came up to me and said, "It's too late, you know, everything's already done." And I was close enough to her that she could smell alcohol on me. And she looked at me and had a look of disgust on her face and looked right at me and said, "Ew, what is that smell?" And I had the same physical sensation that I had in 1984 when that man looked at me and said, "You know, you're so smart, you're so funny, you're so attractive, but when you drink, you turn into a different person." It was the being gutted. It was the kick in the stomach. It was the exact same experience of being confronted by not a usual suspect. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And there were 2 or 3 days left for the conference. I called my supervisor. I said, "Listen, I'm really sick. I'm going back to New York." And the next day I was at an AA meeting.
So you knew where to go after all of this. You still knew where you needed to be.
No doubt. I had tried to go back to AA 2 years prior to that, but I wasn't ready.
So by the time you were ready, you were really ready.
Broken. I was in a million pieces. I was broken and ready to do every single thing that anyone would have asked me to do.
So what kind of things did you do in the early years that you hadn't done in the previous attempts at sobriety that proved to you beyond a shadow of a doubt that this time you could stay sober long term and put together a quality life for yourself?
I will say that the first year I was in a state of of trauma. I don't know how else to describe it.
Mm-hmm.
But that relapse traumatized me. And I cried at every meeting I went to. I was going to three meetings a day. And as soon as the speaker would say, "Hi, I'm Howard, and I'm an alcoholic," I would start sobbing. And that went on for more than a year. I'd gotten a sponsor right away, somebody who was very gentle and somebody who like really helped nourish me back to life because I was so fragile and so broken.
Mm-hmm.
But after that point in time, when I knew I needed to work the steps, I needed to do something else. I was like, if I don't do this differently, I'm going to die. And this woman didn't have a method. And I started just putting out a call for help. Like, I need to find somebody who knows how to do the steps. Because I was in enough pain at that point. And this woman, this angel of a woman, dedicated weeks, months of her time helping me to get through the process of going through the steps in the book. And she changed my life. I hate to make it sound in my recovery story as if I did the steps and then I became a different person, because for me, it doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
The woman said to me, "I'm taking you through the steps because through the steps, you're going to be able to find a higher power, learn how to develop a relationship with that higher power, and that higher power can solve all of your problems if you have that relationship. And my job as your sponsor is simply to shine a light on the words in the book, share with you my experience about that, help you understand what that is so that you can find this power." Because as you know, they say lack of power, like that's our dilemma. And so where is this power? And this woman took me through a process that allowed me to find a power greater than myself, to know in my heart beyond the shadow of a doubt that power exists and that power is accessible to me. And what are the tools for me to access that power? And I have to do all the things every single day. It's mm-hmm. not like, so I'm not one of these people who is going to say, like, I waved the magic wand with the big book and I went through the book and my whole life changed. Well, yes, my life changed, but it changes a day at a time. It changes because a day at a time, I have to do all of the things that are suggested to me. Writing inventory, having conscious contact, doing a ton of service, having a sponsor, sponsoring other women. You know, the women who are in my life in recovery is the greatest joy of my life. You know what it's like when you get to take somebody through the steps and you have a ringside seat to that person's family life improving, that person growing, that person then sponsoring another person. I mean, honestly, to me, there's nothing more dynamic, more exciting, more beautiful, more meaningful. You know, it's all those things that they say about, you know, not regretting the past or wishing to shut the door on it. It's like, why would I? My terrible past, particularly a lot of the childhood stuff and dealing with trauma in recovery, has helped other women. So that all that bad news turned into good news.
Sounds like what she did for you initially turned out to be very prophetic in setting the stage for your ability to feel a real part of the program and to establish a good basis of service for other people and the women that you serve. Can you speak to some things that may have happened or occurred during your sobriety this time that tested your degree of involvement, maybe pulled you out from the center to the edge, or were times that you could truthfully look back now and say, had I not been sober, this, or had I not had the fellowship, that? Can you state a few of those things for me?
It's a really interesting question, because I have always worked a lot. You know, I'm not right now, but during this last 20 years, but in particular, the first 10 to 12 years of my recovery from like 2000 to 2012, 2014, still continued to work, 40, 50, 60 hours a week. The difference was I refused to do it the way that I had done it before, or to allow my job to pull me away from AA. So I've always gone to meetings every day. I've always had a sponsor. I've always sponsored other people. And the one thing that is a non-negotiable is a service commitment. So every single semester, I do not care what's going on in my life. I don't care if I'm in another country. Zoom exists. I can chair meetings on Zoom. The hardest time was probably, when my mother was dying, and I was in New York working, crazy hours, and she was living in Florida. And I would just make sure that I was on a plane at least twice a month, going to be with her, was with her when she passed away, was with her, in her darkest hours, and had a home group in Florida in her town, because I wasn't willing to compromise and knew that I couldn't compromise that, because AA's taught me more than anything. When times are hard, when times are good, when times are fun, when times are tragic, it's time to go to a meeting. It's time to share. It's time to take your sponsee's call. I must. And it's not even that I feel like something's driving me. It's because that's where the joy is in my life. Like, why would I not? That's where the love is. That's where the adventure is. Like, that's where the excitement is listening to another person, is sharing and seeing the light go on in somebody else's eyes. Like, why would I not want that? I mean, I understand that, of course, because I just told you the exact opposite story.
You've really been on both ends of the stick, haven't you? Somewhere in the middle, you've managed to put together all that knowledge and wisdom gained by working and not working the program. It is possible to stay sober and miserable, but it's a whole nother thing to stay sober and have a enriched life. What part has spirituality played in that for you?
I mean, I think that the whole thing is spiritual, because it's all about the human heart. It's all about love and understanding. And to me, in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a Buddhist teacher named Thich Nhat Hanh that always used to say, to be understood is to be loved. And I have felt more than anything in Alcoholics Anonymous that I'm understood and that I have the capacity to understand others. So why would I not want to have that experience?
Obviously, when things are not going well in our lives and we're showing up in meetings and we're sharing about it, people get hope from the fact that here's someone who's going through some really tough things, but they're turning to the program, they're attending meetings, they're doing the things that they need to do to be able to stay sane and sober and reasonably centered while these bad things are going on. But it's just as true in the inverse, where someone's life is really going well. They're getting so successful, or they're having so many good things come their way, that somewhere along the way they start thinking maybe it was them that made all that happen. And that's when the moving away from the program really starts. I've seen people with 20, 25 years of sobriety slip because they just got too successful. AA was working too well in their lives, and they lost sight of the fact why they got successful in the first place. And by not coming to meetings, people in those meetings were not able to hear about how one turns their life around and gets successful in AA. So actually, they're denying other people the benefit of their experience on the good end of things, handling the good things in life.
Absolutely.
I wonder how you've seen that in your own program.
You know, going back to the spirituality question, for me, AA has given me an actual purpose in my life.
Yeah.
A primary purpose is to stay sober and to help another alcoholic to achieve sobriety. And I take that primary purpose very seriously. And the fact that, how do you define success? So to me, success means that my life is of use in a spiritual way, that my life and my recovery is useful to another sick and suffering person. Like, that's the name of the game for me. And to me, there's nothing more joyful or significant than actually having my life mean that much. It's extraordinary. I have had huge financial success. But you know what? That, to me, that is not the promises. You know, the promises is that I have a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, I don't regret the past. I don't shut the door on it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a level of joy and meaning in life today that I get because I have a life of meaning. I mean, I could tell you some very elegant and fabulous and phenomenal stories about celebrities that I've met and experiences. I mean, honestly, for me, that's boring. You know, the person who makes the amend to the father who harmed them the most and then gets to make the amend for their part in it and gets free.
Mm-hmm.
Way more interesting. I think that alcoholics are the most interesting people on the planet and that this is like the greatest adventure that anybody can be on. In my recovery this time, I don't think I have ever used the word bored. How could you be bored?
And I can see the joy in your countenance, how you have lit up as you're talking about all the things that have meant so much in your life and everything that you've been able to give back and how it has enriched your being. And if you, Lisa, as who you are today and what you know from all the experience you've had, if you could go back to a point in your life with the knowledge you have now, to talk to Elisa at an earlier age and influence her in some way or another, which Lisa would it be? How old would she be? And what would you tell her?
Wow, there's so many versions of myself that I would like to talk to like that, but related to my alcoholism and this topic, you know, that we've been talking about here. I would talk to the Lisa that walked into AA on August 16th, 1984, and I would say, focus all of your attention on what is being suggested here, all the tools that are being put in front of you, pick them up, use them, listen, do what's being suggested. I wish I had the opportunity to do that. I try to do that in my life today by being very gentle, but also sharing what it's like when you don't do that with young women. I go to a lot of young people's meetings because I feel like I actually get to save that part of myself every time I go to a young person's meeting and have an opportunity to share about that part of my life and that part of my story.
Well, it's beautiful to be able to share that part of your story in a way that you wish it had been shared with you. Well, you know, this has really been marvelous today, Lisa, getting to know you and getting to hear your story. And I honor your sobriety and the way that you're working your program. And now that you're in another country, starting English-speaking meetings, you have so much to bring to the table and so much to inspire other people in a faraway land that I'm in awe. And I want to thank you for doing this today, and I wish you well in your sobriety. And hope that your journeys back and forth between the U.S. and Italy work out in your favor and that you continue to spread the word of AA far and wide.
Thank you. And I greatly appreciate what you've been doing. This show is incredible. And wish you all the best day at a time in your recovery.
Okay, Lisa, well, take care of yourself.
Thanks for the opportunity.
You bet. Bye-bye now. Well, my friends, that's it for today's episode of AA Recovery Interviews. I want to thank my guest, Lisa F., for sharing her story. And thank you for tuning in. If you've enjoyed the interviews in this podcast series, will you please share it with others? This show is another helping hand of AA we can all extend to alcoholics everywhere. If you want to contact me directly with any comments, questions, or suggestions, simply email howard@aarecoveryinterviews.com. Please also take a minute to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. By the way, this podcast strictly adheres to AA's 12 traditions and all General Service Office guidelines for safeguarding anonymity online. AA Recovery Interviews and my guests do not speak for or represent AA at large. This podcast is simply my way of giving back to AA that which has been so freely given to me. The next episode of AA Recovery Interviews is on the way, so keep coming back. It'll be here soon.